And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. You're very welcome along to the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. It is just turning, as I speak, 5 minutes past nine. And it's good to be back with you. Thanks to Donal, who sat in for me yesterday. Our lines are open for you right now. As usual, we've got lots of stuff lined up, right? But we also like to hear what you want to talk about as well. If there's an issue that you wish to raise or something that's on your radar that should be on ours. WhatsApps and texts, the number never changes. It's 086 60 25000. If you're outside the Republic, 00 353 86 60 25000. If you want to give us a call, 07491 25000. And if you prefer email, it's comments at highlandradio.com. And email if you're listening to the podcast, which is live on our website at 12:30. Or if you are listening overnight, maybe you're a shift worker, it's great to have you on board as well. But don't feel you can't get involved in the conversation. We can pick up your emails and indeed your WhatsApps, if the truth be told, whenever you send them in to us. Right, okay. You can also watch the show as well on our social media channels, YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland, across our Facebook pages and on the X platform. Right, let's have a look at some of the papers that are out this Wednesday morning. We'll start with the Finn Valley Voice. They lead with a sporting headline. Mia McNulty Gallagher claims world kickboxing title. In an inspiring achievement for the Finn Valley community, 11-year-old Mia McNulty Gallagher, a sixth class pupil at St. Fawn's National School, has secured the title of kickboxing 40 kilogram full contact junior girls world champion. Mia from Donnyloop and Castlefin earned her spot at the world championships by excelling in the ISK Amateur Irish Open held in April, a rigorous selection campaign that paved the way for fighters to represent Team Ireland at the prestigious ISKA AMA World Championships in Vienna, Austria, from October 23rd to 27th. So fantastic achievement there. On to the national newspapers now. We'll start with the Irish Times this morning. It's covered widely in the newspapers. Almost 80,000 additional workers are potentially needed to address Ireland's infrastructure deficits, mainly to build new houses and retrofit existing homes, according to a new report from the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council. The research highlights a huge shortfall in essential labour across the housing, health, care, transport and energy sectors, and says that unless systemic issues, including long-standing planning problems, are addressed, the state will struggle to close the infrastructural gap between Ireland and other high-income countries in Europe. While some additional state investment may be required, the report suggests the amount would be modest relative to overall government spending. One of the biggest barriers to the timely delivery of infrastructure projects has been the planning and objection system, with its slow and unpredictable nature, leading to higher costs and longer delays, the report suggests. Okay, 80,000 workers, where are they going to come from? On to the Irish Independent. That sounded like a loaded statement. I mean, in other words, they're going to struggle to find the additional 80,000 workers that are required. On to the Irish Independent now. And interesting, if you've any views on this topic, just 108 allegations of physical abuse by teachers against pupils were recorded by the Department of Education between 1962 and 1982, according to a new documentary. 108 cases of physical abuse between 62 and 82 of last century. And I would say there's more than 108 people listening to us now that could tell their own stories of that, or perhaps even reported physical abuse, but it wasn't recorded clearly. Survivors have spoken about corporal punishment in the RTE documentary Leathered: Violence in Irish Schools, which is on RTE One tonight at 9:35. The programme questions the level of official record-keeping in schools during these two decades. Figures released to RTE show that between 1962 and 1982, 108 allegations involving physical abuse by teachers against pupils were recorded by the department. More than three quarters of those also include allegations of other forms of abuse. There were 87 allegations recorded at primary level, where children as young as four attended a school, while 21 were at second level. So the question is, and many of you might watch this documentary, it might be a difficult watch for you as well, because it's quite clear that often violence in schools or corporal punishment can have a lasting effect on people. Maybe it's a story that you want to share with us. Maybe you want to discuss, was there corporal punishment in your school? Were you the victim of it? Did it have an impact on you? You know, and there are those that will say it never done us any harm, but it did do an awful lot of people an awful lot of harm. Perhaps you're one of those and you want to speak to us, let us know. You can call us in the first instance on 07491 25000. We'd be more than happy to hear your story. On to the Irish Daily Mail now, and if you were an Irish farmer, you probably would be peeved off with this next story, because the use of Dutch cheddar as part of the state school meals programme is one of the best dairy producing regions of Ireland, has sparked fury among farmers. The Irish Creamery Milk Suppliers Association branded the situation an insult to the country's 18,000 dairy farmers, while its president, Dennis Drennan, called it surreal. The situation came to light just days ago after the son of a farmer in the prime dairy-producing region of North Cork came home from school with a wrapper of the 20-gram cheddar portion he'd been given as part of his lunch. An ICMSA member said when his father saw it, he was obviously angry. Why was the government importing cheese from so far away into one of the best cheese-producing areas of the country, which is one of the best cheese-producing countries in Europe? He thought it was mad, and he got straight on to us to find out what was going on. Now, there could be a lot of answers to this. It could be pricing. It could be the actual product itself. I don't know. But it would be a kick in the teeth, I think, if you were a dairy farmer and your young one landed home with a Dutch cheese as part of a state-backed school meals programme. Well, although the Department of Social Protection funds the programme, individual schools are free to buy the food from wherever they want. The Vergeer cheese at the centre of the Raug comes from the south of the Netherlands. The company that makes it boasts, "We've been making ordinary cheese special since 1934. So by the sounds of it, it's down to the discretion of the schools, and maybe they didn't fully think it through. I think that would be quite possible. It's a busy old time in schools. On to the Irish Sun now, and Sinn Féin unveiled its healthcare plan, which has been I think overshadowed by controversy surrounding the party, but I think it's fair. It's only fair in the press, and I had to dig deep in this, to be honest with you. I think it's only fair in the media that you also make the efforts to highlight the positives and the negatives, right? So the positives presumably would be their healthcare plan, the negatives being some of the controversies, and that's applied to, on this programme anyway, that's applied right across the board. And I think really if you pick up papers and you see, you know, negative coverage burying positive coverage, question, you know, what's the editorial policy there? Well, Sinn Féin's healthcare plan includes phasing out prescription fees for all households. The party also plans to recruit an additional 40,000 healthcare staff over 5 years. Again, where are those staff going to come from? It said it would legislate for the change to provide free prescription medicine in the first 100 days if elected to government. Entitled A Prescription for Change, the document includes 350 measures across 60 policy areas in a 5-year multi-annual funding plan. Launching its healthcare policy yesterday, the plan has an additional expenditure of $5.4 billion on the current health budget. And I think really it's very important the electorate knows where that money's going, because sometimes we seem to chuck money at things and there's no return for it. So you get the announcement of the money going in and you think, all right, okay, well, in about 6 months' time, I'm going to have a much better experience. I'll be able to, I know it's not necessarily directly into health, but my child will be able to get, you know, dental checks at school when they should. I'll not have to wait for ages to get into the ED, you know. But often we see these investments and at the front line where we interact with the health service and aspects of it, we don't see the benefits. So if I were a party, I would want to be explaining as to exactly how it will improve people's lives rather than just chucking money at a broken system, some would say. Sinn Féin said it would set a savings and efficiencies target of at least $1 billion, equating to 4% of the current health budget. The party has pledged to recruit 40,000 healthcare workers over 5 years and attract Irish workers home. Okay, that'll be interesting to see how they do that and how they do it sort of with the cooperation of the unions if they try and incentivise that. How closely are you watching the United States elections, I wonder? Lots of people you are watching very closely. It's only a week out now. A lot of Irish national stations are sending a full squad of people over, so there must be a decent interest over here. Donald Trump in the Irish Daily Mirror. Donald Trump has been forced to deny accusations that he was a fan of Adolf Hitler, saying, "I'm the opposite to a Nazi." A week before America goes to the polls, the former president found himself refuting claims that he admired the Second World War dictator in a packed rally in Atlanta, Georgia. a crucial swing state in his race against Democrat Kamala Harris, Trump took a swipe at those questioning his political beliefs and the direction of his campaigns, calling such claims disgusting and just horrible. The 78-year-old said, the newest line from Kamala and her campaign is that everyone who isn't voting for her is a Nazi. Trump then told an anecdote about his father. And I'm not going to go into that anecdote there, but it's very personal. It's very personal. It's not really almost, in fact, in fairness, I think it's Trump's more on policies, whether you like them a lot, migration and inflation. But the Harris camp seem to be panicking a little bit more, and I think it is they that are more prone to personal attacks at the moment than others. It'll be very interesting to see how it goes. And it's a funny old voting system in America. The way the counties, the way it votes, you know, you'll have small states that effectively could swing the election. And you think, well, how could that be? Well, if you look at a map of the population of the United States and you look at the landmass of the United States, while it's all populated, the vast majority of people live in actually quite a small number of areas. And I think this college voting system, it's not quite proportional representation, but I believe it was introduced to balance out the votes. So in other words, even a place with a huge population and a place with a smaller population have an equal say potentially on the outcome of an election. But what it ends up doing is that you've got red states, blue states, and then a few either or states, and then everything focuses on them, and it's a very relatively small population that decides the United States election. Finally, random enough old story, a bizarre collection of hair from famous racehorses, including Irish legend Shergar, Arkle, and the iconic Red Rum. All of those horse names are so familiar to me. They're as familiar to me as George Best, Bobby Robson, you know, Evander Holyfield, different people from different sports. When I was younger, and I'm not sure if it was me or the family or whatever, but I knew horses. Like, I know all of these horses. You name horses from the 90s, and I'll go, I know that horse, and probably could even pick out some of the races that it won. And that's as a young person, not involved in gambling or betting, by the way. You just don't have that same name recognition for horses anymore. Maybe I'm wrong, I don't know. As I say, it could have just been the environment I was raised in. As I say, it wasn't to do with gambling or whatever. It was just, you know, you're watching a question of sport and questions about horses would come up and you'd know the answer. Just doesn't feel to be that way anymore. Anyway, what was I talking about? Right, hair from horses. Equine fan Ray Goddard snipped locks from the manes and tails of top steeds from 1948 and 2003. The collection of 829 clippings is now being sold for the first time at auction and is set to fetch between 50 and 60,000 euro, believe it or not. Cantless championship thoroughbreds were gathered by Goddard, who continued his unusual hobby right up to his death in 2004, I beg your pardon. Ray, who lived in Reading, England, tried to make sure he was present when the hair specimens were obtained to ensure authenticity. I don't know if there's any value to that down the line. Who's to say that DNA technology might advance to the point where an ancestor from Red Rum or a clone of Red Rum could be created from that collection? Hard to know. All right, we'll be back after an ad break with our first guest on today's 9 till noon show. Gardaí are appealing for witnesses following a fatal road traffic collision at Kerrykeel yesterday. And before we get into the appeal, we just want to pass on our condolences to what was clearly, from some of the comments I've received, a very highly respected and well thought of gentleman. Our condolences to his friends and family and the wider community. Inspector Seamus McGonigal, Head of Traffic in Donegal, is with me now. Thanks for joining us this morning, Inspector. I do appreciate your time.
Good morning, Greg.
Right, OK. So maybe you could outline the appeal from Moncada Síochána this morning, Seamus.
Well, as you stated, Greg, there was a tragic incident at Carlin Upper. That's the Shore Road outside Kerrykeel yesterday afternoon around 3:30 p.m. It resulted in the death of a 65-year-old local man. And this morning we're appealing to anyone who's in the vicinity between 3 p.m. and 3:45 p.m. to contact Gardaí at Milford 07491-53060 or the confidential line of 1-800-666-111. And I make the point that it's not just road users, but anybody. There's houses in the close proximity to where the occurrence took place. It's to anybody who may have seen anyone to contact us, please. And if I may also take the opportunity to thank those people who assisted us at the scene yesterday, that their help was very much appreciated.
Any information at all, it can't be too trivial, Seamus. If anyone has any info, just get it to Gardaí. It's very important, not just, of course, to process the investigation, but also there'll be questions that loved ones will have, and I think that's can be an important motivation for people to get in touch with as well.
Absolutely. And so many of these tragic occurrences, families want answers afterwards. They just like to know exactly what happened or what the cause was. And as much as anything, that's part of our remit to understand what happened and to assist families in that way.
Seamus, can you give us an update on diversions? Because I believe the road might be closed for a few hours yet.
Yeah, well, there are forensic collision investigators at the scene at the moment. And I've spoken to them, and the road should be open by noon. Now, again, I'm not saying for certain it will be, but it should be. The only diversions are in place is along the shore road. And the signage is put up with Donegal County Council. I think anybody who's using the roads should follow the signs, and there shouldn't be an issue.
Okay, right. And any information at all, get in contact with Milford Garda Station, 915-3060. The Garda confidential line is there, 1-800-666-111. But any Garda, of course, the information will find its way to the investigating team. Inspector Seamus McGonagall, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Greg.
Okay, and that is Inspector McGonagall, I beg your pardon, who is head of the Traffic Corps here in County Donegal. Right, okay. We are joined on the programme now by Jack. Jack, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Jack, you are just 20, or just turned 20, actually,
yes,
so a young lad.
Yes, sir.
But an awful lot has happened to you in your life. You know, far beyond what should happen to anyone, I suppose, or what one must have to endure through your younger life. You are speaking publicly, sharing your story of drink, drugs, and homelessness in the foster care system. I'm just interested in the relationship between those four things, if you know what I mean. Take us back to the beginning, back to four, I suppose, Jack.
Yes, I was 4 years old in 2008 when I was placed into foster care, and it was quite the jarring experience. I mean, I kind of remember the day that I was put in. I was in this car with a woman I didn't really recognize. I didn't know what was going on because I was so young at the time, and I ended up getting dropped off to this house. Didn't know anyone inside, and I was told I'd be staying there for a few weeks, and those few weeks ended up turning into a few months, which turned into 14 years.
With the one family?
Yes, it was the one family through the entire time.
And no need to go into details, but suffice to say, did the relationship break down?
It was good at the start. I liked the family that I was with. I viewed them as my family at that time. And just as I got older, I kind of got bolder and I got more vocal. And everything started to break down when I was around 17 because I didn't view them as my family anymore. So the relationship started to deteriorate because I was acting out and I wasn't agreeing with them. And I was fighting with them all the time.
And have you? I mean, it's not that long ago, really, Jack. But I mean,
no.
Have you figured out, you know, why you had that reaction? You know, what was it? Just rebellion, and that was the reason, or were you, you know, were you questioning why you ended up in foster care? I don't know what do you think led to that behaviour.
Difficult question to answer because there's so many like things that I could talk about. I guess I felt robbed because I never really had a relationship with my biological family. I mean, they tried, but they weren't the best people, and I didn't really understand that at the time. Because I never really got to see who they actually were. I only got snippets of it. And I guess when I was 17, I was still young. I didn't really know what was going on. So I felt robbed of the fact that I never really had a proper life.
Mm.
I couldn't really relate to people that had done this and that with their family and everything else.
And when you were in foster care, Jack, mm-hmm. obviously there were other foster children in the home. Were they also long-term fostered, or were younger other people coming in and out of your life a lot?
There was a few of them that were only short-term, and then one of them that came in when I was around 7 or 8 years of age, and they've been long-term ever since.
You are from Letterkenny, but you were obviously not getting into specifics, but did you have to move out of the county or just out of the town for your foster care?
I had to move down to the countryside for foster care.
Outside of Donegal, or?
It was still inside Donegal, but quite a while from Letterkenny.
Yeah, so did that affect you? Sort of, I suppose, when you'd moved there at 4, maybe you didn't feel that longing towards your hometown, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I still had a few memories, not good ones, but I have most of my memories from when I was in foster care. But I also still have memories of being in Letterkenny because of foster visits to see my biological family every so often. But I don't really have a kinship with this town like I would if I was born and raised here.
So you moved back to Letterkenny at what age? Was it around 17, 18, 18?
It was the day I turned 18.
Right. And
I moved back into Letterkenny that day.
Did you feel equipped for that, Jack?
I guess leading up to my 18th birthday, there was the plan that I said to my foster parents straight out, I don't want to be here for a second longer than I have to be. So they ended up working with me and social workers and everything else to try and get me a house as soon as possible. And we ended up getting one, and I moved into it the day I turned 18.
Okay. And do you stand by that decision?
Yes and no. I still stand by it because the way I view it is it's my life. I've been with you for long enough. I don't really need to be with you anymore. I'm an adult now. But at the same time, if I could go back and change the way that things were with the relationship as it deteriorated, I would.
Because you were, would you call yourself addicted from an early age, from 13 onwards? What were you dabbling in as opposed to begin with?
I had an addictive personality, I guess. It wasn't that much. My addiction really started when I was 18.
Right.
But when I was 13 all the way through, I was dipping in and out of stuff because it was so readily available. I was smoking cigarettes. I was drinking. I was smoking weed. Any kind of drug that I could get my hand on that I wanted to just try out.
And just out of interest, so were you able to get cocaine?
Yes.
Right. So without going into the ins and outs of it, as a 14, 15-year-old, obviously we're not talking about people, we can't mention individuals, how does a 14, 15-year-old get their hands on cannabis or cocaine, or particularly cocaine, but either or?
Well, I mean, you'd be surprised just how readily available it is. I mean, like, I knew people already that were doing it, and that's what got me into it. And they were able to introduce me to other people that were able to sell it. So, and those people that were selling it didn't really care what age you were as long as they got their money.
And they would also be people within the wider community. That's amazing. I don't think necessarily people get that as much as they possibly should.
No, I'm being deadly serious. Cocaine is much more readily available than anyone would like to believe it is.
So, obviously, whether you liked it or not, there was a structure to your life up to 18. You were dabbling with this, that, and then, but you had a structure. At 18, you've got your own roof over your head, and you can do whatever you want. The reins are off, effectively.
I was left to my own devices. It was, this is your house now, do whatever the hell you want.
So How did that work out for you?
It didn't work out very well, if I'm honest. Because I had so much free time and free reign, my addiction got worse. I was using that to cope with the fact that I had never really lived my life by myself. And I didn't really know what to do. I was living off of takeaways. I was going days without eating just so that I could afford the drugs, just so I could afford the alcohol. And if I couldn't get drugs, I would drink. And I didn't admit to it, but my life was falling apart.
And again, I just want to, how hard or easy was it to get drugs in Letterkenny?
Oh, one phone call. Mm-hmm. All it took was one phone. I already knew who to go to because I had dabbled in it before. So all it took was one phone call and the money there, and I was good.
Have you ever phoned them without money? Would they ever sort of give it to you without payment?
Yes. Cocaine, no.
So how, at that point then, you know, how would you break it? Were you boozing at the same time as well, or?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I was partial to Jack Daniels.
Mm-hmm.
That was my drink of choice all the time. It was the only one I'd go to. I'd mostly drink it straight, but I would drink it with mixers if I was around anyone else. But most of the time I was by myself because I chose to be. I didn't really want to be outside. I didn't really want to do anything.
Did you have any structure here in Letterkenny, though, at that point? You
know what I mean? At the start, no. I was just going day to day to day to day, just doing whatever I felt like.
And did you you know, obviously, if you're procuring... You know, if you're procuring drugs and you know people that know people and all that kind of stuff, would it be fair to say that the majority then of your acquaintances would have been involved in that lifestyle, that you could have been drawn into that lifestyle if you weren't careful?
You'd be surprised that, yeah, a few of them were, but not all of them.
Right.
And not everyone knew that I was doing what I was doing.
How long were
you? I tried my best.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, after you.
I was going to say, then you found yourself homeless. What happened there?
So I had moved out of the house that I'd first moved into when I was 18.
Mm.
And that house only lasted 4 or 5 months. Mm. Then I had moved into another house, and that house had only lasted a couple of months because I had moved in with friends, and because I was still financing my addiction, I couldn't pay my rent, and I was becoming increasingly more violent and just rude towards them because I couldn't afford my drugs as often as I could before.
Mm-hmm.
So the withdrawal was taking its toll on me, and I was taking it out on them. And I ended up getting into a fight with a couple of them, and I just left, and I didn't come back, and I ended up being homeless for 3 going on 4 months.
And where was that, in and around Letterkenny?
Yeah, it was in Letterkenny, yeah.
And does that mean literally out on the streets, or do you describe it as couch surfing, you know, a night here, a night there?
It was out on the streets to start, and then it was couch surfing.
And where would you, not again, we don't want to be specific as such, but just to get an idea, where might someone without a home and in your situation sleep overnight? In a tent?
Anywhere they can get shade. I mean, if you can sleep under a bypass, if you can sleep under a building, if you can sleep under trees, anywhere you can get shade, that's at least semi-warm, especially during the winter.
You talked about the battle between sort of food, rent, and paying for drugs. Can you give us an idea of the cost of the drugs?
I would make a decent amount of money, and I'd say about 80% of that went on drugs.
Yeah.
And the final 20% I'd scrape by with food, and that's where my rent never got paid.
But you tried all different types of drugs. Speed,
everything except injections.
Painkillers, methamphetamines, cocaine, speed. What of those drugs, which was the one that you had to have? Which of those were you actually addicted to?
To be honest, it was a mixture. I used weed to sleep, but I used cocaine to get through the day. So I'd say it would be a mixture of those two, but I was also addicted to alcohol at that time.
So to some extent, and we see this often with addiction, after you had become addicted, you were really self-medicating. The cocaine, the upper, effectively, to get you through the day, the weed to take the edge off it, knock you out for the night till the next day starts.
Yes.
A difficult cycle to get out of.
It really was, and I won't say that I did it alone, because I didn't. If it wasn't for the help that I had, I probably would still be addicted, if not dead.
And I want to talk to you about that, but, you know, did you seek out help at all, you know, before you actually found
out? I didn't necessarily seek out help. To me, I didn't really care if I woke up the next day or not, so help was really on my radar. And I ended up, like I said, I was homeless for a few months, and I ended up getting a message from someone that I had only met very, very briefly.
Yeah.
And because I didn't really care where life took me at that time, I decided to accept their invitation to their home. And when I was at their home...
Is this an intervention? Sorry, Jack.
No.
Okay, so they didn't necessarily know everything about you. They just said, look at... Okay, go ahead.
It was... To be honest, it was just really a random encounter. And when I went to their house, they were doing stuff as well. So we ended up doing that together for some time. But it got to the point where they were older than me, and they said that they didn't really want to live this kind of lifestyle anymore because they had done it for so long. So they said that they were going to try and quit. And because I was homeless, they had offered me a place to stay in their home. And they said, if I'm going to be staying here, then I have to quit as well. I wasn't happy with the idea at start, but I didn't really want to be sleeping under a tree again.
Mm.
So we both decided to quit at the same time.
And how does one go about doing that? I mean, you can't just say, right, I'm not taking anything from today, can you? Did you have any supports, or
quite difficult. I mean, the first step we made was by consciously choosing to say, okay, I don't want this anymore. And the second step was to resist the urge to buy more. Because in my mind, when I would get money the day I would get paid, my first thought would be, okay, I'd put this aside for the drugs and this aside for the food. So the first week where I didn't have anything and I got paid, I really wanted something, but I was more concerned about having a roof over my head than financing my addiction. Because I didn't want to be on the street again. So it was this battle of, okay, you have money, but you don't need to spend it on drugs. You can spend it on things that you actually need. And it was quite difficult. I mean, the first 2 weeks were probably the most difficult because it was detox. My body had gotten so used to relying on the drugs for all kinds of things, getting through the day, falling asleep at night, everything else. So it was like my brain was telling me, I need this, we need that to get through today. And it was more of like, okay, no, we don't. And the first 2 weeks were incredibly difficult because it was always in the back of my mind that I wanted something to help with the pain that I was going through. And it was really, really difficult. But after those 2 weeks, and with the help of my friend, me helping them, we managed to kind of get over that barrier, and as each day went by, I kind of just pushed the thought away.
And obviously, just in terms of so there was no, you didn't engage in any program or anything
as such.
So what did you replace, not that you have to, right, but how did you occupy your day?
Cigarettes. I replaced them with, I was already quite a heavy smoker. But I started smoking cigarettes whenever I got a craving for something else to try and tide that over, because cigarettes you can afford, cigarettes are legal, everything else. And I still smoke today, but not as often.
Mm.
It's just But back then, I didn't really have anything else. So I smoked quite often.
All right, but you're 18 months off booze for the most part and off drugs.
Yes, give or take.
Yeah, bother shouting. How do you feel now? Because, I mean, you know, a lot of this conversation, to be honest with you, has been about really, you know, you didn't care about yourself, really. You were going along. I think you cared about comfort. I think you cared, you know, that it's easier to sleep in a bed under a roof than it is to sleep under a tree in a field. That's just survival, right? But in terms of any sort of love for yourself or value you place on your own life,
has that
returned for you? Do you see the value in yourself?
Slowly starting to come back. I mean, I'm starting to take care of myself better physically and mentally. I still have my bad days. I still have days where I crave this and I crave that, but I've managed to kind of put a block between it where I won't focus on the craving or I won't act on the craving. Mm-hmm. They're still there, and there's still some days where I'm having a really bad day and I say to myself, I'd really love some fucking weed now, or I'd really love a line now just to help me get through this. But I still have that friend that quit the same day I did, so they helped me through that like I helped them.
But because you didn't get any, because you have no other support network, i.e., you know, a White Oaks or AA or what have you, my concern, Jack, is, and God forbid, if one of you fall off the wagon, both of you are falling off the wagon. Would you not need to put some other structure in place there to sort of, for you?
We have faith in each other, and I know in my heart of hearts that I never, ever want to go back to the person that I was then.
That's good.
Because that person isn't who I am.
Yeah, I think really, to be honest, with the life that you have, you're probably only discovering who you are now. Do you understand how people get involved in criminality to fund their addiction?
Yes, I can understand that. They don't have the money readily available, so they do anything they can, regardless of the legal outcome, to get the money to afford their addiction.
I'm just wondering, you know, just as a wider society, I mean, arguably, you know, this all started at four. Without going into the ins and outs of it, your own family couldn't care for you. A foster family decided to take you on, but it's not an environment that is necessarily the same as being with your own family. Then you hit 18.
I won't put them down. My foster family did a phenomenal job.
No, that's not really my point. I'll get to where I'm going with this. One point is it's a different upbringing to others. And then, you know, some people with addiction then might get involved in criminality. They end up in court. It's splashed across a paper on a website, what have you. And people comment underneath, you know, lock him up, throw the key away, scumbag, you know, trash, all this kind of stuff. And I'm just wondering, you know, do we as a society maybe have to, before we do the obvious responses, maybe look at people's backgrounds and how maybe society has failed them and that's the way they are, rather than, you know, nature versus nurture and all that kind of stuff?
Sometimes before you judge someone, especially just sit down and have a conversation with them like we are. I mean, if someone else told you about my story and only told you the bad parts, the addiction, the violence and everything else, you would automatically think, okay, this is a bad person that needs to be put away, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly the point I was making, you know.
That's what you would think. But now that you've sat down and you've talked with me and you've seen the ins and outs of why I did what I did, you can kind of think, okay, I understand to an extent why he's being the way he is or why he did what he did.
Yes, I mean, and it's something we've talked about in this program before, and that's why I phrased my last question the way I did, because I think sometimes we as a society have to take some responsibility. I mean, you've had it tough.
This is
in no way disrespectful to your foster family, who you speak highly of, but at the end of the day, you still remember your life being turned upside down at four, and those things affect people. With that in mind, Jack, have you ever seen a counsellor to talk some of this stuff through? Because there's bound to be stuff, with the best will in the world, there's bound to be stuff that your ducks aren't necessarily in a row in your head on. Mm. Do you feel that, have you had counselling, or do you feel you might benefit from it if you haven't?
I mean, I went to counselling when I was 16 and 17, but it didn't really help because I didn't properly open up. I've been toying with the idea quite recently about going there to talk about everything. I just don't know if I'm ready to face that kind of shit yet. It's more my own personal battle. I want to get into a good place in my life where I can sit down and talk to someone and talk honestly and openly without fear of prosecution or anything else.
Yeah. I get. I do understand where you're coming from.
Yes.
Why are you speaking to me, if you know what I mean? I'm delighted to speak to you, don't get me wrong, but why do you, from your perspective, why are we having this conversation, or why is it important?
Anonymity gives a lot of people quite the amount of confidence they would need to talk about things that they don't want to talk about. So because you haven't seen my face, and because you don't really know who I am outside of what I've told you, it's that anonymity has given me the confidence to come forth and say, okay, this is what happened with me, this is what I went through, and everything else. Mm. Which, and because this is a much wider audience that I'd be speaking to, hopefully someone else can connect with that and get the help that they need.
Yeah, I get you. And so just back to the drugs and the drugs availability and the drugs use, Jack, are there people... I kind of know the answer to this question, but I want to hear it from you, that try and get younger people on drugs, you know, maybe freebies or whatever, and exploit that, you know, or friends getting other friends into drugs, or, you know, because there's an awful lot of drug usage in this county. There's absolutely no doubt about that. It is widely, freely available. Is there any insight into the sort of the drugs game that you can give us as to how young people are finding themselves addicted and what have you?
Curiosity and peer pressure. I mean, like, if you look at movies and stuff like that, the people would be watching, drugs are almost romanticized. And on top of that, they may have friends like I did that are already doing everything, so they get peer pressured into trying it themselves. And then when they try it, they're like, okay, this feels really good, I want to do it again.
Mm.
And once you do it once, twice, three times, you're trickling your way down a river into addiction.
Did you ever, I know you were never sort of fronted cocaine, but did you ever find yourself on the wrong side of a drug dealer? I'm just wondering, or I heard any stories as to what happens if such a thing happens?
I've heard stories, and I can't really say that I've been on the wrong side, because I've always made it my mission when I was on my drugs to have the money there. So I wasn't addicted to the point where I'd crave it if I didn't have money. I'd strategically have my money planned out for the week so that I'd be able to afford my drugs for that week. And I've heard stories of people that haven't done that, and they've had things happen to them. They've had things stolen. They've had their house broken into. They've had their house smashed up. They've had family members hurt. Everything else just to scare them into getting their money.
Mm, it's interesting. What do you want for your future? Because, you know, obviously this is you're in a period of your life now. You've had your life up until 18. You had your life 18 to 20. You seem to be in a good space now, but you just don't want to exist, right? You don't want to exist, you know, drug free.
No,
I presume
I don't
you want to move forward. So what do you want to do with your life ideally?
That's still a question that I wrestle with today. There's so many interests that I have, and music is one thing. Performance is another. Comedy is something else. I want to do something that'll make people feel happy without the use of drugs.
Okay. Listen, it's been an interesting chat, Jack, it gives us an interesting insight and maybe just gives us pause for thought when we can be very quick to judge people that there's...
Yes.
I think society is quite a bit of responsibility to shoulder sometimes because we give up on people very quickly.
Yes, like I said, it's always best to have a conversation with someone face-to-face before you judge them for things that you don't fully understand.
Yeah. All right. Listen, stay safe.
You too, sir.
And go and have that. Whenever it's right, it's no harm having other safety nets, you know, going through counselling and working through the stuff as well. It might just whilst you're in a good space to do it. I appreciate your time, and I wish good things for you.
I appreciate yours too.
All right then, take care.
Thank you, sir. You too.
All right, bye-bye. That's Jack there. Lots of you texting in off the back of that conversation and during that conversation. Have your reaction to it, 086 60 25,000. Some comments before we head towards the news. He sounds like a strong character. God love him. He must have went through hell. He was lucky to have those friends, and they are lucky to have him. Sounds like he went off the rails when he left his foster parents. Does he see his foster parents? Wishing him and his friends all the very best. They deserve lots of happiness and good health. Addiction is a tough road to travel. Interesting conversation, Greg, says another. I know two young lads in the last few months who befriended a girl who got them onto drugs, it turned out. She owed a drug debt and had to recruit people to pay off that debt. Tell Jack to stay strong and be very proud of himself. He sounds like a very honest person. Good luck, and I hope you have a successful life. You deserve it, says another. Another, I see drugs available on Facebook pages. How's this happening? Snapchat is flooded with drugs. And that's it, you see. Where are young people getting the drugs? You know? And lots of things happen too if they get in debt and all that type of stuff. Okay, listen, much more to come in the next couple of hours, but we're going to take a break so we can get the very latest news and obituary notices. Don't go anywhere.